You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, March the 30th. And it's time for our Friday Week in Review, the last one for the month of March. Happy to have with us two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the news of the week. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in with your own observations from the news this week. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. We'll be sure to talk about the latest with tensions with Iran, the bill that passed in the Senate dealing with Iraq and funding and troop withdrawal. We'll talk about the latest in the U.S. attorney's saga and whether or not Alberto Gonzalez is on his way out or not. And other news on the state scene as well. Probably touch on the state Supreme Court race and other things going on under the state Capitol Dome. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Let me welcome our guests. Rick Berg, a former appointee in the Thompson administration, contributing columnist to the Wisconsin State Journal and the Capitol Times, also a member of the governing board of Wisconsin Common Cause. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Also with us is Georgia Durst-Lotti, professor of political science at Beloit College. She's a visiting professor of political science and at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. She is author of Creating Gender, the Sexual Politics of Welfare Policy. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to start, let's start on the international scene, since that's what we're hearing a lot about in the NPR newscast this morning, including the tensions with Iran. We have Iran taking British sailors captive, saying they're going to release one of them, a woman, yesterday, and then not doing that. The Navy's on maneuver in the Gulf. Tony Blair is saying, hey, if you don't give up these hostages, we're going to move this to the next level. How concerned are you, Rick Berg, as to what's going on?
Well, I mean, it's a serious situation. I mean, here you have Iran up to its old tricks again. I mean, you know, back in 1979, they took Americans hostage and held them for over 400 days. And now you've got British citizens being seized in what were either international waters or Iraqi waters. I mean, it's pretty clear they were not in Iranian waters, despite the statement that was released, which could have easily been coerced. But, you know, the interesting thing, Joy, though, is that you've got a regime in Iran who you know, isn't a very friendly regime. And, I mean, this is not the first time they've engaged in illegal activities, and we've known for a long time that they're a supporter of terrorism, not only in the Middle East, but in other places around the world. And it's not disconnected from national politics. I mean, when the Senate and the House take votes on setting deadlines to get out of the Middle East and, you know, for political purposes as opposed to sound military or, you know, foreign policy reasons, it sends a signal of weakness to our enemies. I mean, you know, even Osama bin Laden said that the lesson he took away from Mogadishu was that the United States wouldn't take casualties. And, you know, it's those sorts of things that I think embolden our enemies to take further action against us because they see an opening. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, in this time when we've been talking in the Congress about, you know, setting deadlines and pulling out and defunding the troops and all this sort of stuff, our enemies, and I include those, you know, who are leading Iran right now in that camp, I think see that as a sign of weakness on the part of the United States and its allies. And I think it emboldens them and it leads to situations like this. So people in Congress need to understand that their actions and their words are not disconnected from the reality of life around the world.
Georgia Durst-Lotti?
Well, I think people in Congress are acutely aware that their actions are related to the realities around the world. And I think that when we look at, maybe we should set that aside for a second here and just talk about Iran. It is absolutely true what Rick says, that this is a serious situation, clearly there's a lot of posturing going on by Iran. I've been saying for quite a while that they want to be recognized as a power in the region, and when we went into Iraq, we actually heightened their strength in the region because Iraq itself became so much weaker. And so one of the consequences of going into Iraq was to actually embolden Iran, exactly, but not the way we intended. I'm quite sure about that. I believe that we will be getting, I see some give and take with the Iranians and the Brits, and I suspect that once they can come up with a face-saving way out, that those sailors will be released. One of the things that's happened that Rick didn't mention, which I think is important, is that the price of crude went up precisely because Iran is not entirely stable right now. And that is just one more thing that proves to Iran that it has some clout in the world, and it's one of those things that we really need to watch.
Yeah.
Well, I hope George is right when she says that, you know, cooler heads will prevail and there will be a peaceful solution to this. I don't know if that's where Iran is headed. I mean, I'm a little concerned about the way they're playing games on this and, you know, sort of walking up to the brink. I mean, this is a serious situation. You cannot take, you know, hostages in international waters or in, you know, waters that aren't part of your territorial rights. And, you know, the more they drag this out, the more they invite the wrath and scorn of the world. And in the end, if they don't do something positive in terms of releasing those people, soon they're going to be inviting military action. And I would argue that perhaps that might not be unjustified.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a story in the news this morning that a State Department official is saying that the U.S. is not trying to provoke Iran by putting warships in the Persian Gulf.
Well, they're not trying to provoke, but they're sure trying to send a message.
Well, and they're not trying to provoke. Why would they provoke? But they want to make sure that Iran knows that we stand behind the Brits, which we do, since the Brits are some of the few who really stood with us in Iraq, and we're long-term allies, of course, culturally and other ways. And so, you know, they're not trying to provoke. They can say that.
Right, right.
Yeah. Let's move on to the Senate this week, passing a bill to pay for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also including a timetable ordering the president to begin withdrawing troops by 120 days of passage. The president is promising a veto on this. Should he veto this, Rick Berg?
Yeah, he should. Why? I mean, for a lot of reasons. One, it's just, I think it's foolish to set an arbitrary deadline when you're in a war situation. I mean, it just never makes sense. And I think in this case, what we've got is we've got a Congress now that's controlled by the Democrats. And I think it's become pretty clear that the Democrats are not interested in trying to find a way to stabilize Iraq and make the president's policy work. They're interested in playing to a political constituency here in the United States, and they're doing that pretty effectively. But I mean, I see no evidence at all on the part of the Democrats who now control Congress that they're willing to accept the possibility that the surge might work, that we could stabilize Baghdad, that we can indeed bring the Iraqi government more to the table than they have been in the past couple of years in terms of taking responsibility for what's going on in that country and getting the situation under control. I think they're trying very hard to do that. I think there's some evidence that the surge may be working. I think the incidents and number of violence and you know, explosive devices and all that stuff is down a little bit. Yes, they still go on. But it really does seem to me that the Democrats will not even concede the possibility that this could prevail. And I think that's what's reflected by the resolution that was passed by the House and the Senate. I mean, it's, you know, it's we're out in 4 months, everything else be damned. We don't really care. We don't think this is going to work, and we're going to make sure it doesn't work. And I really do believe that. I just don't think they're interested in seeing the United States prevail or Iraq become stabilized. And there have been a few there have been a few sane voices. You know, Ted Koppel was on Meet the Press a couple of weeks ago. Now, Ted Koppel is not a friend, I don't think, of the administration, but Kappa was making the case that, look, if we don't prevail in Iraq, and if we don't succeed in Iraq, and if Iraq becomes destabilized, it could turn easily into a regional conflict. And that's a serious, serious issue. So there are very serious things at stake here in the Middle East. And I think the Congress is playing fast and loose and pandering to a political constituency at the expense of sound foreign policy.
Georgia.
Well, first of all, it's a non-binding resolution. So, as things unfold, it's non-binding, and the Congress itself may shift what it says if it sees some progress. And one of the huge problems has been the very, very difficult situation there indeed, and is this policy working, and the seeming intractability of what's going on, and Bush's unwillingness to make some changes. And I just really want to call you on one bit of language. What's the difference with playing to a constituency and representing? Representing does include listening to the people at the election time and doing what you say you're going to try to do at an election time. And this is exactly what the Democrats are doing. Strikes me as good democracy here. Now, are they interested in a destabilized region? Well, you know what? We have that now because of really poorly implemented policies from the Bush administration. What the Democrats say they're interested in doing is refocusing on the terrors, on Osama, on what was the problem in the first place that we should have been focusing on all along. So, there's really, really, we are in trouble there. What does it mean to prevail in Iraq? That, is ill-defined. We're not exactly sure. There have been over 400 people killed in the last 3 days. Does this sound like things are settling down? What's clear to me from reading on this is that where the American troops go, things become calm because the Iraqi civilians can trust us, but they cannot yet trust the Iraqi militia, the Iraqi police, the Iraqi army, that there's still so much violence that is perpetrated by them. As I said before, and as many said when they were looking at what policy should be put in place, that a 21,000 surge is simply not big enough, and that may still be the case. And yes, it's better where the Americans are. There's no question about that. But are there enough, and can they actually stabilize? That is another question, and I'm not sure that anything we can do at this juncture, given the mishandling all along, would actually make that possible.
This is the Friday Week in Review. We are talking with Georgia Durst Lottie, professor of political science at Beloit College, a visiting professor of political science and at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, and Rick Berg, former appointee in the Thompson administration, contributing columnist at the Wisconsin State Journal and Capital Times, and on the governing board of Wisconsin Common Cause. We'll go to your phone calls in just a moment. Our lines are full for the time being, but when someone hangs up, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Friday Week in Review. I hope you stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6. It's At Issue with Ben Marins. It's your views on the news after 4. And then we do have a special this afternoon at 5:30. It's the Capitol Steps April Fool's Special. This musical troupe of former congressional staffers takes musical bipartisan jabs at politicians and current events. It's the April Fool's Politics Takes a Holiday Special at 5:30 here on the Ideas Network. I will talk with our guests, Rick Berg and Georgia Durst Lottie, in a little bit about that. What was it? It was the radio TV correspondence dinner at the White House the other day, and Karl Rove was dancing, and
funny, bizarre stuff came out of that.
It sure was.
It was amazing.
Well, maybe we should talk about it now. What was with Karl Rove and that dance, Rick Berg? Do you have any idea?
I don't know, but I don't think he ignited a new dance craze in the U.S. I think I'm pretty sure on that. What he was doing or exactly what that dance routine was, I don't know. But I don't think it's going to catch on.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I had the actual clip, but Georgia Dursleti.
But you have to see it to believe it.
Yeah. Georgia Dursleti, we heard President Bush doing some stand-up there where he said, oh, last year at this time my ratings were at an all-time low and my Supreme Court nominee had withdrawn and my vice president shot somebody. And boy, those were the days.
Those were the good old days.
I know.
Boy, we wish we could go back there.
Yeah, it hasn't been a good many months for the Bush administration. And in fact, let me start taking some calls. I'm going to move on to another issue that is causing some problems. Dave in Menominee, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I watched the Kyle Sampson testimony yesterday, and you know, you learn a lot. You learn many things, and what I learned was. We've got these 30-something ideologues that are put in and are trying to really bend what the United States stands for. Kyle Sampson was just appalling. The Monica Goodling, you know, pleaded the fifth. And what it reminded me of was when NASA would come up with these environmental reports and the White House had these 20-something little kid changing a lot of things, and it would go to this guy named Phil Cooney, who was a lobbyist for the oil industry and who became the chief of staff of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. They changed a whole bunch of stuff, and then 2 days after it passed, he went and became a bigwig at ExxonMobil. And this is just a huge pattern, besides all these other, the huge pattern of corruption and how this abuse just needs to stop. And yeah. I wanted to get your guests' thoughts on that.
Yeah, Georgia Dursleti, you want to start with that?
Well, I believe strongly that the Justice Department is critical, and we really need to have a modicum of independence in the Justice Department. Unfortunately, we seldom do. I mean, I think Bill Clinton got trapped with Janet Reno having her own base of power, and he couldn't get rid of her even if he wanted to. But I think it's more common to have precisely what Dave is suggesting here, the ideologues trying to pursue the line of the president. Now, this is a long-standing tension in American politics, the way in which any political leader wants loyalty to his or her policy, and this is really juxtaposed to an expertise that comes out of an administrative agency of people who are there for meritorious reasons rather than loyalty reasons. And we saw a huge display of this. I would just take a little bit of a side twist here on Gonzalez in general and say that some bloggers have put forward kind of a conspiracy theory, not really conspiracy theory, but you know, it's a diversion from what's happening in Iraq, and it was actually the administration itself that put this on the front pages and is keeping it on the front pages. And you know, while I can't imagine that that Gonzalez would be happy with this, there are ways in which it's interesting that we have been following it. I was in Serbia last week, and the State Department people I was working with there just kept shaking their heads that we were worried about this Gonzalez thing rather than what was happening in the world. And so that just gave me a little different perspective on it than I would have otherwise. Interesting.
Yeah, Rick Burke?
Well, wouldn't we like to think the administration is that cunning and smart? I don't know if they are. I mean, sometimes these things go on in politics where you try to move something else to center stage, but I don't think that's what's happened in the Gonzalez case. I don't think that's been intentional. The fact of the matter is that U.S. attorneys do serve at the pleasure of the president, and Clinton fired, I think, 93 U.S. attorneys. Bush fired 8, I haven't seen any compelling evidence that they were fired for inappropriate reasons, but I guess we'll have to wait for the full record to come together on that. I think it's pretty clear, though, that what's happened has been poorly mishandled in terms of communication. But if poorly mishandling something, in the public arena is grounds for criminal charges or dismissal, I don't think there'd be many people left, for instance, in the Doyle administration. And I think the Bush administration might be sort of thin on ranks, too. So getting back to one thing the caller said that touches on that issue, it's a trend that we've seen in both parties, these sort of younger ideologues. And it isn't just the Republican Party. It's the Democrats, too. These zealots that you know, sort of take over. I suppose, you know, maybe I'm saying that as more of a, you know, someone who's been around the block for a little while longer. But I think there's a need in both parties for more seasoned, reasonable, mature voices. And I don't see enough of that, frankly, in both parties.
Well, I will agree as somebody who's probably been around the block a few times too, Rick.
Well, thanks, Georgia.
that we really have, you know, exacerbated the capacity to do good governance by the increased partisanship that we have had along these tough ideological lines. I just want to go back to one thing, though. The whole Clinton fired 93, Bush fired 8. Clinton did exactly what other presidents have done, including the beloved Ronald Reagan. When he came in, he asked all of the Republicans who had been appointed by the prior administration to step down. That's what he did. What Bush did this time in firing these 8 midstream is new, is different, and does strike at the tenuous balance that any prosecutor has to hold in public service, that they're trying to do the work of the judiciary, which is not always entirely consistent with the work of the president. You're right, technically they serve at the pleasure of the president, but this broke tradition in a very important way that strikes at the independence of the judiciary to pursue, for example, corruption charges against members of Congress, of the party, of the president, which is part of what's at stake here in a very, very central way.
Yeah. Wasn't one of the key parts of this Kyle Sampson's testimony yesterday that he contradicted what Alberto Gonzalez said about the handling of this? Alberto Gonzalez reportedly said, I really wasn't heavily involved in deciding that we would, you know, that these 8 would step down or be fired, and I didn't see any documentation about this. And this Kyle Sampson said, well, we had extensive conversations about this, and essentially saying he was not. Not telling the truth.
Yeah, I certainly, if you listen to the Democrats, yeah, I mean, he did contradict Gonzalez, but I don't know if it's a matter of semantics or what. I mean, it's hard to say. When you look at the, and I guess we'll know when Gonzalez testifies, which he will before Congress. I'm just reserving judgment on that until I hear what Gonzalez has to say about that. But I think it points out why people are sort of reluctant to talk to Congress about these issues, because Congress is clearly now, I mean, Congress is engaging in scandal mongering right now. I mean, they're looking for anything they can do, anything they can find to embarrass the Bush administration. And I think, you know, when they can come up with what they perceive to be a discrepancy between what one person says and another, then they, you know, play one off against the other. And I think it's sort of like the Scooter Libby situation. I mean, there was no underlying crime really in what Scooter Libby did. His crime, if there was one that he was convicted, came when he, according to, you know, the verdict, lied to the FBI.
Well, the crime was Karl Rove's, but Scooter Libby got hung out to dry.
Well, I know, but so when you get into this whole murky, you know, political world, I mean, it's understandable why now more people in Washington are reluctant to say anything, and why more people may start taking the Fifth, because they don't want to find themselves in a situation where they could be charged with perjury or whatever the case may be, or lying to Congress.
Well, exactly. But you know, CQ had an article yesterday, the day before, that talked about the ways in which proportionally Democrats have been over-investigated. So to say that Congress is engaging in scandal mongering really ignores everything that has been going on, in which the Democrats have been under disproportionate scrutiny by the Justice Department and other modes of investigation, 6-1, if I'm remembering what the CQ report said. So, you know, and CQ is not a partisan organization. You can't, they just lay out the facts in a very good way. So, you know, that there's been a lot of investigations going on, and they've been aimed at the Democrats. So to have the Democrats come back and say, wait a second, why are you letting these prosecutors go when they are looking at Republicans, and Republicans perhaps should be looked at? I think that this is at the heart of the problem. And, you know, if Gonzalez was not paying attention to something, as was suggested by his top aide, if he wasn't paying attention to something that would inevitably hit the front pages because it was such a change in tradition, in practice, in policy, then more incompetence in the Bush administration. I would give Gonzalez one out. And that is, what does it mean to be heavily involved?
Yes.
You know, what does it mean to be heavily involved? If you're the Attorney General, you are involved in lots and lots of things. Mm-hmm. So what defines heavy involvement? And I think therein lies the question on truthfulness. And, that's one of those areas that's really hard to
one way or the other. And I would agree with that, which is why I don't want to go too far, with what was said yesterday, because it could be that Gonzalez was informed. He may have even attended a meeting where the issue was discussed, but his interpretation of what heavily involved means may be different than that which was portrayed to the committee yesterday. So I would agree with you.
It sounds like he was involved. He was informed a lot, and frankly, he should have been informed a lot on something that was this big.
Well, so, you would expect him to be.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if he wasn't.
It is to me, he looks like he's in big trouble, although I think the Bush administration will stand behind him because that's what Bush does.
Yeah, well, I think what will determine his fate is when Gonzalez appears before the congressional committee. I mean, that will make or break the case, I think.
Let me bring in some other callers. Art in Milwaukee, hi, you're next.
Hi. Well, I'm calling about Iran, and it's kind of remarkable sense that we aren't provoking them. But I must say, as a lawyer, to confuse the fact that every time a new administration comes in and replaces all their U.S. attorneys with what Bush did is just, it's an appalling statement of the record. But the idea that we are not provoking Iran, I mean, both Scott Ritter and Seymour Hersh say that Bush is, chomping at the bit to attack Iran and start, there could be another war there. In the middle of the night, the BBC had on all the ways that we're provoking Iran. They had a former CIA guy talking about that we're likely promoting insurgency of the Kurds in a couple of other areas. And do you remember that we arrested their consul in northern Iraq? This is a violation of international law. And according to the BBC, they're still all being held incommunicado. Even if someone is arrested, a regular person, like for drug dealing, under the Vienna Accords, they have a right to see their counsel. These are all diplomats who have been held now for weeks and weeks and weeks, and according to the BBC, they haven't had any contact, whatever. The Iranian officials don't know anything about where they are. So we're holding those people hostage, and how can we not remember what we're doing to the Iranians to try and probably provoke a war?
Yeah, and some are speculating that the British sailors were in Iranian waters on purpose. So you don't believe, though, Rick Berg, that there's any provocation going
Well,
on?
Well, let's just take that for a second. If the British soldiers were in Iranian waters on purpose, I doubt if they were there by order of the United States of America. I don't think that's likely. In terms of provocative, well, I don't know. I mean, our mere presence in the Middle East, I suppose, could be parlayed into some way as being provocative.
Seymour Hersh and others are saying the war with Iran has already begun.
Well, I don't know. We've talked about that before in the show, and I really don't buy into the notion that Bush is itching to attack Iran. I just don't. It's in my gut, I guess. It's my gut telling me that that's not the case. I've read those same articles, and I've heard those people that make those claims. It just seems to me that we've got our platter full in Afghanistan and Iraq right now. I don't know if we need to open a third front in the Middle East. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, I still wouldn't count the Israelis out in terms of whatever needs to be done in Iran. If there's something that needs to be done in the way of surgical strikes or whatever, I have felt for a long time that Israel is the one most likely to do that. But I don't buy into the notion that we're itching and we've got our finger on the, you know, on the trigger to try to get into Iran. I just don't see that. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to me right now.
You don't see that either.
But let me add one other thing. But it doesn't help Iran's cause when they seize people and hold them hostage, mm-hmm. whether they were, I don't care whose waters they were in, and most of the evidence indicates they were in international or Iraqi waters. Again, that does not help Iran and the world community, and it's the sort of thing that invites sanctions and or military action, so it's not smart.
Yeah. Professor Drislati?
Well, I think we are stretched so thin right now that I can't imagine why we would want a war with Iran. I mean, they're a big, powerful country, actually, and I think they want to be recognized as such. And so if we talk about what's their cause, the cause in the world community, it may not make them beloved by the world community, but it does raise their standing in terms of a power to be dealt with, to be reckoned with, and I think that's their cause. Just back to Art's notion, I don't think that we would say we're going to provoke. That's what that was my point earlier. Of course, we're not going to say we're provoking, which was the exact statement. But anything we do there can be provocative. Mm-hmm. And so absolutely the things that we've been doing have been at a minimum peaking at Iran, and we really are playing with fire, but the whole area is a tinderbox. And so somebody told me that it was a good cop, bad cop thing, that, you know, the U.S. can be the bad cop and the EU can then be the good cop. I'm not sure I buy that, but it makes more sense than some of the other things, like we really want a war with them.
We are talking with Georgia Drislati. She's a professor of political science at Beloit College, also with the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison as a visiting professor of political science. And Rick Berg, former appointee in the Thompson administration, columnist with the Wisconsin State Journal and the Capital Times, and also with Wisconsin Common Cause. And we welcome your contributions to the Friday Week in Review. What happened in the news this week that you would like to discuss? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We're going to move on to some state issues coming up after this break. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you. And according to Kathleen's guest after 9, modern warfare is drastically different due to the Bush administration's vast use of private security forces. They'll talk with the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, coming up after 9 o'clock. We are reviewing the news of the week with our weekend reviewers, Rick Berg and Georgia Drislati. And I wanted to transition into some state issues here. I know that Governor Doyle was actually in Washington testifying before Congress saying, please let Wisconsin save our senior care program, grant us another waiver so our seniors in Wisconsin don't have to sign up to Medicare Part D for their prescription drug coverage. But, Georgia Drislati, it seems to me that the word is that may not happen, that the feds may not go along with that and probably won't extend this waiver and let senior care continue in Wisconsin.
Well, that's the way I read those tea leaves, too, mm-hmm. and that is a sad, sad thing. Senator Cole had it right. This is a no-brainer. We have a terrific program here in Wisconsin. I think some of the listeners know that my mother-in-law has Alzheimer's, and this is by far better for her than any of the other options, and we look very closely at this. And it's also so much easier to use, and we have we actually negotiate the cost of these drugs, unlike the federal program, so it is just far superior. And there's the only reason that they need to do this is because it threatens this bad program that they have in place at the federal level. And you notice that if you look at some of the budget details that they're starting to talk about, they're even talking about cutting federal funding for Medicaid, which leaves this program looking even better to Wisconsin citizens. So it's a great program. I hope that we just keep banging the drum and not capitulate easily.
With all of George's comments in mind, I would remind everyone that senior care began under a prior administration, didn't it, Georgia, under a Republican administration?
Well, it's a great program.
I know.
It's a great program.
I just wanted to stipulate that for the record. It is a great program, and it's worked well for a lot of people in Wisconsin. But I think the conclusion is unmistakable. The feds want to push everyone towards Medicare Part D, and I just don't think they're going to be agreeable to continuing or to going along with the continuance of the program. I just don't see it.
Yeah. It's not a state issue, but
it's unfortunate, but there's a lot of things unfortunate about the healthcare system in the United States. I mean, this is just one part of it. I think on the face of it, this makes sense, but what we need, I think, is a more comprehensive approach to healthcare. And we're not getting that, at least not in a bipartisan way.
This is not a state issue, but the talk about health care just reminded me of the John and Elizabeth Edwards appearing on 60 Minutes on Sunday talking about their decision to continue on with his presidential bid in light of the reoccurrence of Elizabeth Edwards' breast cancer. What are your thoughts on that, Georgia Durst-Lotti? Polls are showing that 2-1 people think that they made the right decision, but they are also concerned that John Edwards will end up withdrawing from the race, or many of them anyway.
Well, even if he doesn't end up withdrawing from the race, I think the underlying problem is that if she goes, you know, let's just play this out. He goes all the way through, he wins the election, and then she has problems while he's president and he's distracted. I mean, I don't know how people, and he would be distracted if your wife was dying, right? I don't know how people can ignore this. So on the one hand, there are way too many Americans who have had experience with cancer, and they know that there's a big difference between being declared incurable and being declared fatal, and that it's really important to keep your life going while you're in at this stage. And so I think that there's a great sympathy for the Edwards right now, but at the same time, I just can't believe that it's not going to have some effect.
Well, you know, Georgia touched on some things that have occurred to me too. I mean, Edwards, I heard this morning, Edwards got about a 9-point bump in the polls as a result of this. And I don't think it was, I'm sure it wasn't done for political reasons. I just don't buy into that. But there was a sympathetic bounce in the polls that he got. But when you just look at the issue, I'm sort of torn about this. On one hand, I admire their determination and the fact that, you know, all the statements about how they're not going to let cancer control their lives and they're going to keep plowing ahead. That's admirable. But on the other hand, you know, if I were John Edwards and this were my wife, the mother of my children, the woman I've, you know, been partnered with and loved for all those years, I don't know if I could do that, meaning running for president, knowing what kind of time that's going to take away and what she's about to go through, which will be a very difficult time. And I wish the best for them, and I pray for her health. But I don't think I could do it. I mean, they've got two young kids at home. What are they, 8 and 6, something like that? And when you look at the time demands that running for president puts on your life, to say nothing, as Georgia suggested, of if he were to somehow prevail and get elected president, and then he's got two still relatively young kids at home. He's got a wife who's very ill and could be terminal. Who knows? I couldn't make the decision John Edwards made. I think at that point you yield your personal ambition to your family, and your family becomes the priority. At least that would have been my decision. But I don't want to be critical of the decision made by the Edwards. It's not for me to decide. Everyone has to decide this for themselves. So I'm not going to sit in judgment of what, John Edwards and his wife do here. But I know I couldn't have done what he did.
Well, and, you know, I mean, just to circle around again, Rick, you and I aren't going to run for president.
probably not.
It takes a special person. It takes a special couple. And they've been through it. They know what it is. And so it actually makes sense to me that this is more empowering for them than withdrawing. That makes sense for me. I just think in the long run that it will be a strike against John Edwards as people actually think about who they're going to vote for, because they can't help but know that this has to distract from the 24/7 job that the presidency is.
Well, one person who is now saying that he might run for president is this former Law and Order actor and former Senator Fred Thompson. And I caught a blip on the news the other day, Rick Berg, that polls are showing that he's doing quite well, too. And it's like, you know, what does that mean? That the Republicans are searching for the right candidate if Fred Thompson's going to, you know, like, become a front runner when he says he might run?
Well, what it means is that I think there's a significant portion of the Republican Party that is concerned that there is not a prominent, genuinely conservative candidate in the field right now. I mean, you've got Giuliani leading most of the polls, but Giuliani is very liberal when it comes to Republican politics, you know, pro-gun control, pro-abortion, some personal issues regarding marriages, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. But I think in general, Republicans have been willing to overlook that in favor of the leadership that he showed on 9/11 and in the aftermath of 9/11. But I think there is a lingering concern in the Republican Party over the fact that there is not a real sort of Reagan-like conservative in the race. And I think Fred Thompson comes as close to that as anyone. Now, the bad news is that a lot of people in the Republican Party are talking about a Thompson candidacy. Unfortunately, it's not Tommy, it's Fred. you know, and that's sort of an interesting situation, too. But I don't know. Fred may get in the race, but I think that's what accounts, answer your question, I think that's what accounts for all the speculation and the commentary about Fred. And maybe, who knows, maybe there'll be a Thompson-Thompson ticket.
There we go.
And they could arm wrestle for who's on top, but I'm guessing neither one of them wants to be in second place.
I was going to move on to another issue, unless you have some comments on Fred Thompson, Georgia Gerslotti.
Two quick things. One, I think there's more evidence of celebrity in politics and the way in which that's rising. And I can say that by watching Fred Thompson on television, that I actually like the guy. You know,
he's a good guy.
He plays such a good character, and he seems so smart and able. And so there's this blurring of entertainment and politics one more time. The other thing I would say about Giuliani and Fred Thompson and the Republicans, we're going to see this core constituency of the party people be at odds with where maybe they need to be to win the general election. The latest Pew poll showed that 51% of Americans now claim to be Democrats or leaning Democrats, and they're back to 35% for Republicans, and that's a huge shift.
Yeah, but I think there was another poll recently that came out, well, I think it came out this week, that I do believe showed both Giuliani and McCain beating either Hillary or Barack in head-to-head matchups.
So they need to be in the middle, is my point.
Yeah.
So the people who vote in the primaries on the Republican Party will be at odds with those what they need to do to win the general.
And I would agree with that. I don't think. But Fred Thompson, I think, is a very likable but reliably conservative Republican. I don't think the Republicans can win the presidency in 2008 with a hard right candidate. I don't think that's going to work.
Let me move on to a race right here in the state of Wisconsin. Next Tuesday, we go to the polls to decide who should be the next state Supreme Court justice. We have Washington County Judge Annette Ziegler and Madison attorney Linda Clifford running for this seat that Justice John Wilcox is retiring from. There will be a debate tonight, by the way, the We the People Wisconsin Forum between these two candidates. Citizens will be asking them questions. We will air this live on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio at 7 o'clock tonight. It will also be on Wisconsin Public Television. So I got that plug in. Georgia Gerslotti, what should we be listening for and watching for in that debate?
Well, I think, unfortunately, for the justice system, Justice Wilcox has it right. There's something wrong with the way we're doing this. I mean, clearly there's way too much money being spent on this, and the partisanship of these justice candidates is apparent as the nose on anyone's face. So I actually think that the close partisan ties are what's going to decide this race, and it doesn't really matter what they say anymore, and I think that's way too bad.
Rick Burr?
There is something wrong with the way we conduct these races, and it's called money. And it's true of all the statewide races in Wisconsin. The role that money plays in statewide races, I don't care if it's governor, attorney general, Supreme Court, it's just way out of control. And I've seen, we're seeing the effects of that. And until we do something about that, I don't think anything's going to change. I think it'll be interesting tonight to see if Annette Ziegler brings sound effects with her to play the howling wolf at the end, that we get at the end of that TV ad. I mean, some of this stuff has been sort of cartoonish and juvenile, and I think embarrassingly so for a Supreme Court race. This is not the way, I guess, I envisioned a Supreme Court race unfolding in Wisconsin. I guess I'm naive and idealistic enough to still believe that the level of debate would be a little bit higher, that, the issues would be, a little bit more intellectual. And instead, we're being treated to, another expensive round of mudslinging and allegations, and you're corrupt and I'm not, and I'm a judge and you're not, and I mean, it's just sort of embarrassing, isn't it?
I think it is beneath the dignity of the court, and I, again, having just spent some time in places where the courts really aren't as independent as they maybe should be, I think that an independent court is central to any well-functioning democracy, and so this really needs to be something more than we're seeing right now. The one thing I would say for Linda Clifford is that I think it's important that Lee Sherman Dreyfus has come out on her behalf. Shows something a little different there than I guess I was surprised at that.
Yeah.
Well, I think she was helped by that, but I think her showing in the primary was so abysmal. And frankly, Ziegler's showing in the primary was so strong that I think there was an image cemented early that Ziegler was the odds-on favorite, which I think helps account for why the race since then has been so nasty, because they're busy trying to tear each other down.
There was another recent poll that did show that Ziegler had higher name recognition than Clifford in this statewide poll, but it was, I don't have it in front of me, but it was 10% of the people who said they were likely voters or some number that low actually knew what this race was all about or that this race was even happening.
I saw a poll recently too, I think, where they polled Wisconsin citizens to see who could name a member of the state Supreme Court, and I can't remember the number, but it was fantastically low that very, very few could name even one, which is sort of sad because it's a very important body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's not going to be a big voter turnout probably next Tuesday.
And that, back with Ziegler in the primary, I mean, what were the more important races up and who was drawn to it? I think that has a lot to do with that turnout there. And so, I don't think it's over till it's over on this one, but I just agree. I think Rick and I agree on this, that this is not the way you're supposed to elect.
No, and again, it's
select Supreme Court justice. There are other ways to do this that are better.
Right, but we've got to do something about money in political races. Got to address that. I don't have the answer necessarily, but we've got to sit down and figure out what to do about that, because it's corrupting the whole process.
Yeah. Are either one of you know what's going on with American Idol?
No.
Oh,
okay.
Sanjaya.
I
try to follow it as best I can. The flip flopping hairdos and everything, it's fascinating.
Well, I just was going to leave us on a light note, but we really don't have time. Sanjaya is a bad singer who keeps on staying on with the votes because people are crying
teens in the audience.
Yeah, they're
crying girls. Yeah. So I mean, it's sort of interesting how that has developed into a controversy and about the voting and exactly what's keeping him on the show. Frankly, I don't think he's that bad a singer. He's not the best singer in the competition, but I don't think he's that bad. But it's sort of interesting the way that's playing out. Georgia, do you have a comment?
I don't
watch it. I really don't. I can't.
I only got involved in that show because my 12-year-old daughter used to watch it, and so I had to watch it to keep up with the discussion.
Yeah,
I'll use that as a defense.
We cover all the important issues on the Weekend Review.
Good father defense. Good. Okay.
Thank you. It's the good father defense.
Yeah, we're out of time, so we'll leave it there. Georgia Durslotti, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Georgia.
Yeah, and Rick Berg, thank you, too.
Thanks, Georgia.
Thanks to Leo Duran and to Carmen Jackson for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.